Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
Thank you for joining Let's Talk today. I would like to, as a visitor to this place, acknowledge the Turrbal and Yuggera people, and I'd also like to acknowledge the First Nations peoples on the land in which you are standing, the listener. I would like to acknowledge our elders, both past and present, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. You've joined us today for a special Let's Talk as we commemorate the anniversary of the National Apology to the Stolen Generations made by the then Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. It was 9 years ago today that he said sorry to the Stolen Generation and for the forcible removal of Aboriginal children from their families. Joining me today is Dr. Deb Duthie, an academic, social worker and senior lecturer at the Ujuru Unit at Queensland University of Technology, to reflect on the significance of the apology then and now. Welcome to the show, Deb.
Thanks, Chelsea.
Now, before we get into it, I'd like to tell our listeners who's your mob, where you come from and a bit about yourself.
Okay. So mob are Waka Waka and Warramungu. So on my grandfather's side, they're Sherbu people, and on my grandmother's side, she was born at Brunette Downs in Northern Territory, hence her last name being Brunette.
Mm-hmm.
And she was removed with her siblings to the Barambra Aboriginal Reserve, as the Sherbu was called then, and grew up there, raised a family. I was adopted into a non-Indigenous family, as quite often what happened back in those days. So I traced my family around about 20 years ago. So I found my mother and two older sisters and four younger brothers.
Wow, so 20 years ago.
Yeah.
How old were you then, can we ask?
Oh, I don't know about that. I would have been early 30s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you always know that you were adopted out, and did you know that you're Aboriginal?
Yes. Yeah. Mum and Dad, I can't remember when they told me. I just always knew that I was an Aboriginal kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was adopted. And but there was also that kind of secrecy around it as well. So it was okay that family knew, but it was, you know, don't tell people outside of the family. And I think that would have been Mum being protective.
Yeah.
And when kids did find out, it was a very trying time, especially for a little person.
Because where did you grow up?
We travelled pretty much everywhere around Queensland when I was a kid, because Dad actually worked in construction. So, I lived at Mount Larkham, Brackenridge, Gladstone, Boyne Island, Charleville. So, yeah.
Wow. And what made you, can I ask how your family reunited? Or what was the, what happened, what prompted that? And
what prompted it is I think I'd always wanted to do the tracing. And the partner I had at the time, it was okay if he knew I was Aboriginal, but he didn't want anyone else to know I was Aboriginal. So effectively,
wow.
I kind of married a racist.
Bless.
Yeah, so it was when that relationship was finished that, I decided to find out where they were. So
how did you go about that? What was the did you use LinkUp, or what was the process for finding out?
Initially, I started looking myself through electoral rolls and that sort of stuff, but we just kept on coming up with dead ends. So I ended up going to the Family Tracing Service at the Salvation Army, and they found her within a matter of weeks.
Wow.
So, yeah, at work one day, and I get this phone call saying, we've traced your older sister and she lives in Goodna, and she wants to meet you. So we arranged a meeting, so I met a niece and a nephew as well. And then a couple of months later, my mother came up, and we met for the first time in the park.
What was that like?
It was really quite scary.
Yeah.
but I think it was probably scarier for her.
Yeah.
We had to, there was two of the brothers had also come up as well, so it was a big family gathering,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Yeah.
But we had to sort of shoo them away and have a bit of, you know, quiet time to ourselves and that. So, and we still keep in contact, and
When you met your mother, for the biological mother, for the first time, did you feel that bond, that connection, or what did that feel like?
Yep, I first thing I noticed was her hands were exactly like mine, or mine are exactly like hers.
Yeah.
That was the most striking similarity, I think. The photos I had previously seen when I'd met my older sister, she there were photos of my mother when she was young, and, yeah, the similarities were... So it was actually really nice to look like someone, because, you know, I do look different from my family. But, yeah.
And how did your adoptive family, I know, don't mean to refer to them that way, but how did they feel about you reuniting with your biological family, and what was that like?
They always said that they would support me in that. However, when I did do it, I didn't tell them, and I probably told them a couple of years ago.
So why didn't you tell them?
I didn't want to hurt their feelings.
Yeah.
That was the biggest thing. They raised me, they're my family.
Yeah.
And I guess I didn't want Mum to think that they were going to be sort of pushed out of the circle. So, yeah. But, she was great. Her and Dad were fine, you know, when I finally did tell them and showed them some photos and that sort of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you still keep in touch with family and...
Mm-hmm. Yep. One of my sisters is, she's done a social work degree as well, so that was kind of an interesting link. Whenever my mother comes up, she lives in Adelaide at the moment, we tend to catch up and have a bit of a yarn. But, yeah, it's interesting. And I guess I've met more aunties and things now, and it's really quite a pleasant feeling when someone tells you that you really looked like her when she was young.
In your reuniting with your biological mother, your natural mother, or I'm not sure what terms you prefer, did you talk about the circumstance in which you were adopted out, or were some of those feelings there, or sort of what happened and why? Those questions.
I think it was more for her to get that off her chest that she needed to say. She was very apologetic. That was not what I wanted. I mean, she was a black woman. It was in the 60s. She was single. She was working in Brisbane as a domestic. The odds were kind of against her.
Yeah.
So she said it was strongly suggested to her when she was at the hospital that the best thing would be to give up the baby.
Yeah.
So if you think, I guess, of that sense of powerlessness.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't uncommon, that experience, for a lot of Aboriginal women who are single mothers in that situation.
Yeah, and for my adoptive family... for them to adopt a pure white child, so to speak, that was up to 7-8 years. For me, it was 6 weeks.
Wow.
So, and, they just wanted another daughter, basically, so...
Fascinating. So how many siblings do you have in your adoptive family? Just so we can talk about family.
I've got two older brothers and an older sister. So I'm the youngest in the family.
You're the baby.
Yeah. And I just assumed I would have been the baby in my biological family as well. It didn't even dawn on me that there would be six others.
So where are you in birth order?
I am fourth. One baby passed above me. So there's the two girls, the baby, me, and then the four boys.
Can I ask, and if I'm prying, you can tell me to stop. Was there talk about biological father and...?
That one's a mystery.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and, she just won't go there. And that's her right to do that. So that's okay.
Do you feel like there's a piece of the puzzle missing, not knowing, or you're at peace with?
Not really. No, I'm okay. I think I'm happy that I found her. Siblings are a bonus.
Yes.
As our nieces and nephews, and all of those.
You had this expanding family in your 20s, 30s?
Yeah. All of a sudden, kaboom.
Wow. Mm. So it's fitting that we're yarning to you today on the anniversary of the National Apology. What I thought we'd do is we'd actually, to commemorate this day, is play an excerpt from Kevin Rudd's National Apology that was issued, and we'll cut to that now.
Today we honour the Indigenous peoples of this land, the oldest continuing cultures in human history. We reflect on their past mistreatment. We reflect in particular on the mistreatment of those who were stolen generations, this blemished chapter in our national history. The time has now come for the nation to turn a new page. A new page in Australia's history by righting the wrongs of the past and so moving forward with confidence to the future. We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these our fellow Australians. We apologise especially for the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, their communities and their country. For the pain, suffering and hurt of these stolen generations, their descendants and for their families left behind, we say sorry. To the mothers and the fathers, the brothers and the sisters, for the breaking up of families and communities, we say sorry. And for the indignity and degradation thus inflicted on a proud people and a proud culture, we say sorry. We, the Parliament of Australia, respectfully request that this apology be received in the spirit in which it is offered, as part of the healing of the nation.
So in hearing those words back, do you remember where you were when he gave the apology? Tell me about where you were. And
well, I was working, social worker by trade, so I was working in a homelessness accommodation program. And there was four other people in my program as well, so we all got to work early and set up the telly and sat there and watched it. It was in complete silence.
Yeah,
it was really... we all teared up. It was, I think for me the biggest impact was that it recognised those events that occurred for our elders and, you know, and of course now their families still, but
Yeah, I flew down to Canberra for the apology. And got to stand on the lawn outside Parliament House, and it was just this... It was an amazing experience because, you know, we all, we were, when we went down, I went there with a couple of friends and we were all, you know, carrying our flags and our colours and, you know, we were representing going down there. And what was fascinating for me was that the nation was a part of this historic occasion, which is unusual for us as Indigenous peoples to have our stuff included. So I remember we were, and we flew back the same day and made it to Musgrave Park in the afternoon where there was an event on as well. And it was walking through Brisbane and I saw people having, they had flags on their cars, not Australian flags, they had Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flags on cars. People were, you know, there was this Indigenous presence on the streets. And I remember walking down the street in Brisbane and cars were tooting their horns and it was this, we were finally included in the nation's consciousness in a way that was respectful and that our pain, our stories actually mattered. And I remember tuning into the news that night and it was showing across the country. You know, there were places where the big screens were up where people were watching and crying and cuddling and it was the nation had this moment. And it was surprising to see that it was one of our moments that the nation shared in. Did you feel that kind of the sentiment around the place at that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was the impact of it, I think, it's kind of really hard to explain, really.
Yes.
It's just a kind of feeling that is in the air almost, you know. So, but the fact that we were all celebrating this one thing.
Yeah.
And everyone was brought together was quite astonishing.
Yeah, I think the closest thing to that was the walk across the bridge, the reconciliation walk was, wow, we're actually walking together as a nation and we're actually included. We're, you know, so it was a really it was a new encounter to have that experience, and it was so pleasing to see. There was some controversy on the day because the opposition what do we call the opposition Prime Minister, Nelson. Brendan Nelson, he followed Rudd's speech, and a number of people on the lawns and in Parliament turned their backs on his speech. And I also turned my back during the course of his speech. It wasn't that he got up to talk that I turned my back, but the things he was saying were really unnecessary and offensive. Do you remember his?
Yeah. And I remember clearly stating to my colleagues that, you know, what he was going on about was a poor example of trying to get his opinion across.
Yeah, because he did said things like he was sort of reminding us about the disgraceful conditions and assuring the nation that no one should feel guilty about this. And I liken it to, you know, when you go to a funeral and someone delivers a eulogy, which is kind of, you know, and it celebrates someone's life. It's kind of like getting up after that and reminding everyone of all the misdeeds that that person had done. And you kind of go, actually, that's not what you're supposed to do at these times.
Yeah, it kind of fell completely flat and just almost destroyed that that feeling and excitement and enthusiasm for what had just had occurred.
Yeah, and what it's interesting is that that apology was an acknowledgement of what I think Rudd referred to as a blemish or, the sort of dark time in our nation's history. But it wasn't about white guilt. It was actually about us coming together as a nation and commemorating and sharing in the pain and trauma that people have experienced and continuing to experience as a result of this policy. And so it was, I get confused when we talk about our history, our nation's history, that people get quite defensive about it and see it as, oh, well, you're blaming me for what, you know.
Yeah, and you as a fellow academic know how challenging it can be to do this in the classroom.
Yes. So you would teach about...
Yeah, so I teach in the Indigenous Knowledges Minor at QUT. It's a series of four units, and we look at cultural safety, representations of Indigenous peoples, politics, and also some research subjects. The unit which I do, which is the political unit, which I get strength from doing that that particular lecture series, because it's about activism and it's it fires people up.
Mm.
But there are always students who do feel that they are being blamed for the history. But if you don't know the history, how can you make sure the past has changed? You know, that we don't do the same thing again.
Absolutely. We might just cut to a break, and I want to come back and explore how you work with students around some of these issues, including our Indigenous students and non-Indigenous students.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
Thank you for joining us on Let's Talk this morning. We have with us Dr. Deb Duthie from QUT's Oojuru unit. Today we are reflecting on the anniversary of the National Apology to the Stolen Generations. We're talking with Dr. Duthie about history and teaching students history in higher education. So, Deb, you were talking about the encounters with students. And what are some of the responses that you have from students about learning about our nation's history, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous students in your classroom?
Yeah, so, you know, it's important that that is a culturally safe space, both for Indigenous and non-Indigenous students. You know, I usually start the series with a bit of a caveat saying there are things that you are going to learn about here that you may have a range of emotions about. But most students, I guess, tend to want to know what that history is. And particularly around the policies that were written all through those years and how they didn't work, so they changed them, and then they didn't work in those, so they changed them again, and every time it just didn't seem to get any better.
Yeah.
Some students go very quiet and choose not to engage in the conversation, I guess, sometimes. But others will clearly see the links between their family's past, particularly if they lived on land, on farming land and that sort of thing, and they recognise that, well, hey, whose land actually was that?
Yeah.
So if it gets students to start thinking about this stuff, I always say to them, if you can convince someone else in your family that this is an honest view of history, then you're actually starting to be an ally around this sort of stuff. But, yeah, they do struggle with it a bit.
Do you get much resistance from students around engaging with historical truths? And is it different when you have students doing the Indigenous Knowledge as minor versus teaching to students who are doing it as part of a compulsory unit?
Mm. Yeah, as a compulsory unit, extremely difficult. Students will quite blatantly say, why do we need to know this stuff? I'm not going to work with Aboriginal people. That's a far more challenging teaching perspective, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, and given I was teaching in the social work discipline and they're not going to work with Aboriginal people, well, I don't know about that.
Oh, that's fascinating, isn't it? And you would I would think that social work students would have an understanding of things like intergenerational trauma and kind of you get to understand people's circumstances and how they... Would you not think that social work students might be more open to that as opposed to, say, like someone in engineering or mathematics?
Yes, I would like to think that people would do that. It's just a defence... A complete defensive sort of thing. I mean, I've had papers with the wind shuttles work referenced in it, which gives me an indication of where that student might be at.
So Keith Windshuttle is a historian?
Yes. Who has a very different view of what our history is.
And because he contests that there weren't that many children removed, and if they were, it was for their own good. We're kind of paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
But he's been a kind of a quite a vocal kind of outspoken around
the furphy of the stolen generations.
What is that about, do you think, this need to deny this or downplay it or dismiss it?
Yeah, so the, you've had the apology, it's time to move on. The interesting thing I find is that, I've also taught in, multicultural studies.
Mm-hmm.
Students are enthralled about multicultural studies. They want to know about different cultures and their different ways of seeing and being and doing. But when you start talking about Indigenous cultures and ways of being, doing and, and knowing, there just is that sort of shutdown.
So what do you think that's about? Is it about wanting to learn about the culturally other who's far, far away versus when we deal with what is called Indigenous content, their proximity to that? There's a sense of, well, we might be complicit in this?
I don't know. I think there is a fear of being out of the depth and that it's easier for them and less confronting for them if they don't engage in that. Whereas when you get students who are really interested in this and really want to make a difference, they ask questions and they, yes, they're all terrified that they're going to offend, but at least they learn then how to ask questions in a culturally safe manner.
Sure. Are you surprised as a university educator of the, that you're seeing each year new high school leavers coming into your classrooms? There's been a big push to embed Indigenous perspectives in, high school curriculum. Are you seeing that change yet of students who are aware of this nation's history, and are we becoming more enlightened about our nation's own history, do you think?
Not a great deal. No, I still have students saying, you know, I'm so angry I was not told about this at school.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so those things are sort of just going, you know, or they may do a surface level of, you know, colonisation or something, but it's not that in-depth stuff where people have to really think about that history and what happened to those people and...
Yeah, I still encounter lots of students who are in shock.
Mm.
And, yeah, there's some that are more angry than Indigenous students about hearing some of this history. And I remember growing up, Dad would often tell us the story of our great-grandmother, Nena Slocke, and how where she her family worked. Of when the government officials would come, the station owner would let them know when they would flee across the New South Wales border and hide out. So most of our families have grown up knowing this because, you know, our families lived it, either being subjected to it or trying to evade it. And so it's interesting to me that there are people who have no idea what has taken place in this nation in their name.
Yep, that's right. And then when things like, was it the... in Howard's era when all of a sudden that we were going to take over everybody's backyards and that pandemonium, you know, behaviour that people come up with.
Yeah. The other argument around the apology that we heard a lot, and we still hear it today, about that the apology was just a symbolic gesture. And we hear that from our own community as well. I'm not discounting it. Is there an importance to have symbolic gestures, do you think, around things like this?
Yeah, look, I think symbolism can make things noticed, certainly. But I think it's more important that, you know, something gets done after the symbolism. So, yes, it's good that this symbolises something for our country, but what then?
Yeah.
So has anything really changed for MOB?
Do you think that that we did see a change, either in relations, in our history? Do you think there's been a change since the apology? Do you think if Rudd had not issued the apology, we'd be in any different place than we are now?
Well, I suppose you could say that, you know, we've moved forward in small ways. You know, maybe people are a bit more interested in what happened in the history, but you still get those comments of, we've said sorry, you know, we don't want to hear you anymore.
Well, that's a funny thing. So I always hear that anything that comes up with Indigenous issues, you get people say, well, we've already apologised. And it's like, no, we apologised for the forcible removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, which was one part of our experience, but we kind of haven't dealt with the rest of it. And I think there was some of the critique at the time going, well, he's apologising for that one, but what about the rest and this unfinished business of treaty? Because you can,
Well, that's right,
So people tend to think that apology was like a cover-all for all the oppressions that Indigenous peoples have experienced.
We're done.
We're finished now.
But the thing with Rudd's apology, I think... it wasn't as strong, perhaps, as the Redfern speech.
The Redfern speech. So tell us about the Redfern speech for those who aren't, because a lot of people don't know about this Redfern speech. Mm.
Yes, so Paul Keating, one of our prime ministers, sort of came out, and I think it was a bit of a surprise even, came out and said that we were the ones, as in the non-Indigenous people, were the ones who took the children. We were the ones who wrote the policies. We were the ones who, you know, instigated all of these policies and issues that occurred. And that had so much power in it when he said that for me. That was a really powerful speech. And he just hit it on the head.
And it was, I think it was like World Indigenous Peoples Day or something in the 90s, 94 maybe. But for our listeners, you can YouTube Paul Keating's Redfern speech. Yep. It is well worth listening to because I don't think we've ever had a Prime Minister that has been prepared to tell the truth to the nation, who at that time wasn't ready to hear those truths. Mm-hmm. We saw the backlash from the Keating era in Indigenous affairs with the Howard government, and of course we had Hanson's One Nation Party, and there was a lot of talk that the pendulum had swung too far. Mm. And that what was needed was a new paternalism in Indigenous affairs, yes, and no more black armband view of history.
No. So we'll put in this 10-point plan, and that will sort everything.
Yeah. Yes. So when we talk about our history, our nation's history, are we wearing a black armband? Well, do you think it's important that we should continue to always talk about the history of this country, or is there a point that we just have to move on and stop talking about it?
I think we do need to keep talking about it. I think we need to keep talking about it for our kids. Mm. I think we need to keep talking about these things to non-Indigenous people in all ages and brackets, because this is how it gets known, and history needs to be known.
Yeah, there's that saying, a nation that doesn't know its own history is condemned to repeat it.
Yes.
We still see today that the removal of Aboriginal children from their families, that is a much higher rate now, I believe, than during that time. Mm. So we are still doing that in a different, some would say a different kind of way, or have justified that. But surely, in looking back, there's lessons to be learned about the impact of those removals. Because it wasn't just about removing Indigenous children from their family, it was also removing from community, from culture.
Yes, yeah.
Which is a different dynamic for a non-Indigenous child being adopted out to a non-Indigenous family of the same community and culture.
That's right, yeah.
And we see today many people still connecting, and it's not just connecting with one's biological family, but connecting with community, mob, and being part of the community, not just
I'm still doing that. I still meet people and they'll go, oh, you're related to so-and-so. And, it's just one of those things that is an ongoing thing for me. But it helps form that identity, and I think history is part of Australia's identity and Aboriginal people's identity, and it needs to be told.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been with you in Cherbourg for different things, and I remember seeing some of the aunties, they place you as...
Yes, yeah.
I forget. And how does that feel in terms of your identity, of having them aunties placing you?
It's a very warm feeling.
Mm.
Because it's that, again, it's that sense of belonging that I've not had before.
Yeah.
That I didn't sort of grow up with. It's important.
Yeah, and I mean, today we still have many Indigenous people who are still yet to find family, be placed within family and make that connection, and for various reasons either can't find where their mob are from. And that's still lived out today for them. It's something that can't just be moved on from, because there hasn't been that placing back into our families.
Yeah, and like, some of the research that I've been on too, where we've worked with young Indigenous people in schools, fascinated about the history, wanting to know where they're from and who the people are in that particular country. These are 16-year-olds, at the cusp of their adulthood, and they're still trying to find where they fit within, in their lives. So, we've got to keep talking about it.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Duthie. We might just cut to a break and we'll talk some more about today, the anniversary of the National Apology to the Stolen Generations.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
Thank you for joining Let's Talk this morning. We are commemorating the anniversary of the National Apology to the Stolen Generations. My guest this morning is Dr. Deb Duthie from QUT's Oojuru Unit. And we're reflecting on the importance of the apology back then and today. Do you think, Deb, that we should be commemorating the anniversary of the apology each year? It should be in our calendar and nations to continue to mark this day?
I'm not sure, actually. I guess, you know, it is, again, it's part of our history. And I think any of those historical things need to be, celebrated, I guess.
Yeah, when we think about Anzac Day, Remembrance Day, do you think it's helpful for healing to have these events that mark, remind us of our dark past, so to speak, that a nation does remember these things and does take time out to reflect on these things?
Well, I mean, let's have a look at, like you said, Anzac Day. That's a very important day in the calendar that is recognised, as opposed to Australia Day, perhaps, and all the debate that's going on around that. What if someone came up and said, well, we're not going to celebrate Anzac Day anymore? That it's not part of...
It's too negative?
It's about death and destruction and war, and there's nothing positive in that. So, I find that sort of interesting that there's such a big pushback on changing the date of Australia Day, but yet other things that have been... continue to be celebrated in Australia, a big issue is made of it, of the importance of recognising that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think as a nation we're at risk of knowing too much about our own history, given the students we encounter.
Yep.
One of the challenges I have in teaching Australian history and Indigenous people's experience of Australian history is sometimes... Well, it's not a good story to tell, but sometimes in talking about the legislation and the various policies that were inflicted upon Aboriginal people, I sometimes wonder, and I'm conscientious of, whether I am reminding students about the lack of agency of Aboriginal people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you teach a unit called Smash the Act.
Yep.
Which refers to the Act, which affected, I think, not one Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person in Queensland does not have a relationship to that piece of legislation.
Yes.
But yours is called Smash the Act. Can you tell us about that course?
Smash the Act. It focuses on political history, but also talks about, what's sort of happening now, and at the moment. I think a lot of our... history can be based on the negative aspects that occurred. But within this unit, it's about the activism of people. People like G. William Cooper, A.M. Fernando, what was the black man doing over in England and Europe protesting in the 1800s? It's just astonishing. Fred Maynard and, the AAPA. All of those sorts of things. And for me, I get strength out of that. People were not, I can't think of the word, were more capable of defending themselves around the policies and things that were happening. We didn't just sit back and get walked over. I mean, look at the Commonwealth Games protest.
Yeah.
And I love watching the footage of that, and I can't wait until next year to see what's happening down the Gold Coast.
I'm sure something will be happening.
Yes, well, I see they're getting asking for volunteers, and I'm just wondering how many Aboriginal people will be allowed to volunteer.
Troublemakers. Hey,
indeed.
Yeah, I mean, that's the exciting part of history for me, is not to tell people, look how terrible things we are. We are victims and we're hapless and hopeless. It's going, look at what we've endured. Look at what we've resisted. Look at how we've resisted. And actually celebrating Indigenous and non-Indigenous resistance to this history.
Absolutely.
Because we have had allies along the way. And... it's balancing that, dealing with stuff that may feel make students feel uncomfortable, but not to the point where they're overwhelmed about how depressing our state is, but rather being inspired by Indigenous activism.
Yeah, absolutely. And we look at, within this course, we look at activism in art. So, you know, we look at Aki and we look at Bennett, and students have to do an analysis around that, about what they think that artist was actually trying to say within their message. And you get some really good responses. People actually really think about it.
Yeah.
So, you know...
And people, because people forget that we have activists who march on the streets.
Yep.
We have activists who do their work, their activism by their art. In all kinds of spaces, we can see Indigenous activism. And I get excited seeing the different sites in which...
I mean, look at film, you know.
Absolutely.
There are so many spaces that activism occurs, did occur and is still occurring. And I like to focus on those things because it, it takes it away from that deficit... approach, you know.
Yeah, because, you know, we often hear people think about history in terms of guilt and, you know, we're constantly, you know, disclaimers to students saying we're actually not wanting you to feel guilty because guilt is not a useful emotion. We want you to understand and we want you to understand why this matters in the contemporary context because they often think of history as far, far away, as colonisation was 1788, as though it was an event and not an ongoing system of oppression for Indigenous people every day. And to get understanding lived history, because it's lived in us and in them, in how they've come to think about us and relate to us. I mean, the fear during the Howard era is about... Aboriginal people taking their backyards and stuff like that. That's nothing new. Okay, I thought today, but given the nature of the show, the date today, it is the anniversary of the National Apology to the Stolen Generation. I thought we'd end the show today on a song by Archie Roach, Took the Children Away. Your thoughts on this song?
I love this song. It's It's overwhelming sometimes, but it tells a story and it tells it in a beautiful way, you know. And for me, that's another form of activism, is the words that Archie Roach comes out with.
Yeah, I think the song, and I'd encourage listeners to, I know we've probably all heard this song, but listen to the lyrics and think about its significance on today of all days, because he sings about a mother and father who love their kids and their fight to keep their kids and the children coming back. And we hope that as we move forward, so to speak, we hope that our children will continue to return home and find their family and their country. Thank you for joining us, Deb.
Thank you.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.